Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Joshua Frank. He's co-editor, along with Jeffrey St. Clair, of the radical magazine and website Counterpunch, found online at counterpunch.org. His most recent book, Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion, was published by AK Press and co-edited with Jeffrey St. Clair. Their forthcoming book, due out next fall, is Heatstroke, Earth on the Brink. Or is it Earth of the Brink? Earth on.
Earth on the Brink.
Okay. Earth on the Brink. So my first question is, you've also written a book about how the Democrats gave us George Bush. And I'm guessing you would say the same thing in many ways about Trump. So can you sort of defend that claim and talk about it a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. Big fan of you and your work, obviously. I think it's really important to, in this new era of the Trump administration, where it seems like every day you get a new news clip or something pops up and you're just like scratching your head wondering, how the heck did we get to this place, right? What is going on? Why is the world burning? And I would say, of course, it's been burning for quite a while now, and especially on the political front, the Democrats haven't been putting out the flames. And I definitely would argue that looking back at this last election, it probably, at least in the last 8 years, what we've been going through is this sort of sleepwalking sort of activism. And I think a lot of that has to do with Obama. And the fact that Obama was able to co-opt a lot of movements that were going on, very similar to how Bush was able to, or I would say actually Al Gore back in the early 2000s was able to co-opt in some ways the anti-globalization movement that got turned into the anti-war movement, similar to how Occupy Wall Street got sort of absorbed into this into the Obama campaign. And the fact that Obama was pretty, probably the hippest president we've had, at least in my lifetime, right? There was no opposition to his drone strikes, to his awful environmental policies, you name it. And I think what that did was put progressives and radicals on the back burner even further than they used to be. And when we look at this current election cycle, there was a little hope with Bernie Sanders' campaign, especially among the left, that there was going to be this challenge to the Democrats and the control of the White House, and perhaps that we could get some progressive movement going on healthcare, on student debt, on a number of other issues for workers and the environment in some cases. But what we saw and what I warned about and a lot of others as well was that let's not put our faith into Bernie Sanders, let's not put our faith into the Democratic Party, because in the end they're not only going to let us down, but what they're going to do is co-opt any kind of progressive movement that could be building, or radical movement that could be building. And we could go back in history, of course, and the Democrats have always been the graveyard of social movements. So now here we are, right, in this first just past the 100-day mark of the Trump administration. We've had a couple nice protests. Certainly the first one, the Women's March, was, I think, definitely important to bring people out and to, in solidarity, that here we are. We're not all, excited about the prospect of the Trump administration, whether we liked Hillary or we didn't. I think that was a feel-good moment for many, many people that were utterly depressed that Trump came out victorious. But now here we are, and how do we foment that into an actual political reality, into a movement that can sustain change in a way and also challenge the capitalistic society that is dominating every ounce of our culture and continuing to destroy the planet? And how do we do that? How do we still bring hope to that movement, right, without getting too locked in a depressive state, and also build an actual movement? And again, I would argue that the Democrats aren't the tools to get to that place, and regardless of what they might tell us. Because at the end of the day, when it comes down to who they want us to vote for, they're never going to allow us to vote our conscience, right? They're never going to accept the fact that there might be a more progressive candidate or a more radical party out there that stands up for a lot of the things many of your listeners and Counterpunch readers would believe in. They will tell you that you need to vote for the lesser of two evils because the prospect is just too dire, that the prospect of another Republican administration is too great. And I would argue that the reason we have right now Trump in the White House is because the Democrats are spineless. The Democrats don't speak for the people. They don't speak for the environment. Instead, they speak for their corporate, you know, donors and the capitalistic Wall Street, you know, money drivers that fund the campaign and control Washington. And, you know, here we are, of course, and the capitalist society and the rich benefit no matter who wins of the major two parties. And of course, we're seeing that play out right now. And the Democrats aren't holding Trump's feet to the fire, whether it's, you know, bombing Syria or his grotesque environmental policies. They pay lip service to resistance, but they aren't going to lead that resistance. There's just no way.
So I have a sort of amorphous series of observations that is going to lead to the question, how get specific if you can, how do the Democrats co-opt these social movements? How does that happen? And so do you want me just to leave that, right, or do you want me to make some amorphous observations first?
Well, you could. I know where you're getting, and I'll feed off of some of your work on this answer too. You know, let's look at, for instance, the anti, or however we want to call the movement, the climate change movement.
I want to make one observation of my amorphous group. Okay, a moment for me was George Bush the First said publicly that he wanted to gut the Endangered Species Act. And this was remarkably unpopular, and he was not able to do it. And then Bill Clinton talked about the importance of the Endangered Species Act as he defunded programs that were necessary to implement the Endangered Species Act. And so this was like, wait a second, he's just a sneaky,
right?
You know, I don't know what words we can use on the radio. You know, it's like he's he's just being sneaky. He's accomplished. He did more harm to the Endangered Species Act than George Bush the First did with his bluster. And that was a huge moment in me figuring out that these people are not honest. Anyway, so throwing that out. So how? Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead. How do they do it?
Well, I mean, another example with Clinton too, and you know this very well, where you live and where you've researched a lot of things. Look, I mean, Clinton was also, I would argue, and a lot of others would argue, more detrimental to our forests, and their logging increased dramatically under the Clinton administration. There's a number of things that the Democrats have done to set the wheels in motion for neoliberal policies that essentially eviscerate protections for the environment. And let's look back in the last few years. We did have this movement kind of coming to fruition, the climate change movement, in regards to the Keystone XL pipeline. And it was led by some people that I have a lot of respect for in certain ways, like Bill McKibben. But I'm also very critical of Bill because at the end of the day, I believe Bill is a Democrat. And he was unwilling to break from the Democratic Party in order to put the environment first, because he was afraid of the alternative. But meanwhile, Obama was paying lip service to that movement that was happening in front of the White House. But ultimately, he was okaying the southern portion of the pipeline. And meanwhile, he was greenlighting all this, you know, obviously fracking was unhinged during the Obama administration. And he was talking about that being such a wonderful thing for the environment because it was replacing coal. But of course, as we know, it's just as detrimental to the climate in many ways as coal is.
And coal, by the way, coal use in the United States went down, but coal exports went way up. during
under Obama. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Coal extraction actually didn't go down either.
Right, that's absolutely true. We are shipping a lot of it over to Asia to, you know, power the plants that produce the goods that we end up buying on our shelves here in the U.S. And you know, look, it's the Democrats that have set these wheels in motion, and it's the, in this case, the environmental movement that has been unwilling and unable to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire, because so many of the big green organizations are tied to the liberal enterprise, as I would call it, which are completely tied to the Democratic Party. So you don't see any real watchdog going on because of the fact that these foundations and the big green groups are essentially Democratic front groups. And I would say in this case for the environment especially, there's simply no real movement afoot that will hold both parties equally accountable. Like at the end of the day, the Sierra Club, for instance, is going to endorse whatever Democrat comes out, even if that Democrat doesn't support the agenda, the alleged agenda of the Sierra Club. So what are voters supposed to do if they're, you know, somebody opens their, an old lady opens her mail and the Sierra Club, who she gives money to and trust, tells her that she needs to vote for Hillary Clinton because of the alternative's just so bad, she's going to do it, and they have a lot of power. But ultimately, that voter and that constituent is voting against her own agenda and her own wishes. And the Sierra Club, for instance, and others obviously play into that. So that's one of the ways the Democrats are able to co-opt movements, because they control the enterprise that attempts to lead those movements.
So it seems to me that one of the primary arguments used by every Democrat in the past, I don't know, at least 25 years, probably going back, let's go back 35 years at least, the primary argument they have used to get people to vote for them is, vote for me, I'm not a Republican.
Right.
And would you agree with that, generically?
Well, generically, that's definitely their argument. I would argue that they are Republicans, right? Republican lights in some ways. And but ultimately, it depending on what your idea in the political spectrum is, they're both to the right of center on most issues. So a lot of voters that would be progressive voters or radical people that don't believe in the system, want to challenge the system from the outside. There's very, very few people, especially at the national level, that are speaking to those people and to those issues. So the discourse and the debate is completely controlled by the two major parties. And a perfect example of this is the debate commission, which is controlled by the Democrats and Republicans, and they set up enormous barriers to basically force third party candidates to throw in the towel, because there's no way that they can reach the threshold in order to get onto the national televised debates. And as you know, unless you can get on the national televised debates, you have no shot at anything, because that reaches the biggest amount of people. The last one to do it was Ross Perot, and Ross Perot was only able to do it because he was a billionaire and he was funding his own, you know, TV ads and his little campaign 30-minute snippets about how he was going to destroy the economy. But now here we are with these barriers set up, so it's nearly impossible at the national level for third-party candidates, someone, you know, a Green Party candidate like Jill Stein or whoever it may be, to get onto these national debates that people, generally normal people sitting in their living room watching the television, might start agreeing with. You know, I always think back to 2000 and I wonder, what if Ralph Nader would have gotten on one of those debates? He would have turned it upside down, and I think it would have been a three-way race. And I still believe that. And I think it's even harder than it was in 2000 for that to even happen, because the barriers are such that even getting on the ballot in certain states is nearly impossible unless these small parties can raise a bundle of cash.
You said that the Democrats, you would call them Republicans, Republican lights. And that reminds me of a great line by Gayle Dines, who says that if the left is at minimum anti-capitalist, there is no left in the United States.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think on the political front, that I think that's a very accurate statement. I come from, like you, I come from the environmental movement. So my politics are more influenced by Ed Abbey than they are by Karl Marx in some ways. I tend to look at things a little bit differently, more from an anarchist perspective. So I do believe that there is a left in the U.S. and there is an anti-capitalist left. It's just not one that gets the TV time.
Well, we can also say, and this is certainly true for, I mean, for me, the question always is about environmentalism is,
right,
are they more interested in preserving the economy or preserving the real world? And of course, most environmentalists who are not funded by Patagonia fall into the latter camp, or the former camp, where they're primarily interested in saving the economy. And they say this explicitly. You know, you mentioned Bill McKibben, and he and I have had mm-hmm. some exchanges where, I mean, he has been tireless in raising awareness of global warming, but he says it's explicitly to save this culture. He doesn't say this is explicitly to save birds. And he and I have communicated about this. And that for me is the, we can say the same thing. Like Gail Dines would say, there is no organized left, if that means anti-capitalism. And I think you and I could agree that in terms of actual political power, there is no one actually representing the walruses.
Right.
In terms of
political power. No, absolutely not. Yeah. This is the fault of the eco-capitalists, right? I mean, these are the ones that believe in that cap and trade can save us. But ultimately, what they're looking at is saving the economy, and that's what Bill McKibben is saying. He wants a quality of life for humans that is at a certain level, no matter what, and really from that, disengages from what that impact is on the natural world. And of course, that's obviously a whole conversation in itself, but that's a really big problem with the Greens. It's a big problem, I think, with our political system in general. That there is no movement that's challenging the system itself. There's only little splinters that are picking off little issues to stand up against. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the system that's still in place, and it's the system that's running things. And whether it's Trump or it's Clinton at the helm, the world is going to suffer environmentally and from a social justice perspective.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing. That this, Chomsky has been saying for decades that the system is extraordinary in that it set itself up as a two-party, one-party system. And do you want to respond to that at all? I don't want to get to solutions yet. We're still too early in the interview for that.
Yeah.
But I still want to talk about the problem a bit more. So, mm-hmm. so how...
Let's talk about foreign policy then, for instance, right? I mean, because this is something that it breaks barriers from administration to administration. The same policies, foreign policy apparatus is in place. So we can look at Iraq, for instance, that under Clinton was getting bombed every day. I think there's a very good argument to be made that Al Gore, after 9/11, would have supported or gone into Iraq just like Bush did, maybe under different pretenses, but he probably would have gone after Saddam at some point. And of course, during that period of time, plenty of Democrats, almost the entire Senate Democrats, supported the invasion of Iraq. They all supported the invasion of Afghanistan, and they continued to do so under Obama. And here we are now in the Trump administration, and this so-called war on terror is still going on. We're still in all kinds of countries in the Middle East, and now it looks like we're going to be engaging in Syria at a higher level than we were before. And where's the resistance within the Democratic Party? There is no resistance because the Democrats support it. And in fact, there's lots of reports coming that have been coming out for the past few years that Obama was pushing back on the generals that were telling him that he needed to go in and take out Assad in Syria. But he was pushing back and tried another method, and it didn't really work out for him. But now he's out of the way, and Trump, who knows what Trump's agenda is ultimately, but we know that the apparatus is still in place, and we also obviously know that Trump has bombed Syria. Is he going to, and now there's also more troops in Syria, is he going to escalate that? It seems likely, but he's certainly not going to curtail it, and he's certainly not going to curtail our actions in Afghanistan and in Mosul and in Iraq, because, you know, this so-called war on terror is in full throttle, and it funds a lot of the military-industrial complex in the U.S., and the Democrats aren't going to challenge that, and the Republicans obviously aren't going to challenge that. So here we are, stuck with no alternative, at least at the political level. And that's, I think that's a perfect case of capitalism run amok and the military. In our day and age, I don't think that we can separate the two, military and capitalism. It's the same thing because one functions with the other.
You know, I want to tell a little bit of a story, and this is kind of cheating as an interviewer because I'm going to take too long, and it's supposed to be about you. But remember the 1992 Rio Summit?
Yeah.
The big Earth Day. We're going to save the planet. 1992. Okay. Beforehand, there was a representative from the United States government and a sort of part of the delegation of the UN went around the country, accepting people's input in city to city about what they wanted the United States position to be. And when he came to Spokane, which is where I lived at the time, a line formed around the whole inside of the building with people who wanted to talk. And our message was, do not support capitalism, do not support sustainable development, which is an oxymoron and is horrible, an excuse for destruction. Mm-hmm. Stop, you know, get the United States out of non-industrialized nations. Don't industrialize. The message was great. You would have loved it. I loved it. It was perfect. Person after person basically giving the same sort of talk that you or I would give.
Mm-hmm.
We get done, and the guy gets up, take two steps to the podium, and says, I would like to thank all of you for supporting the United States position that sustainable development is the way to go, which was entirely the opposite message that all of us had given. And the punchline to the story is I was talking to the person who brought him later, and evidently he was so drunk that she had to help him to his seat before the event started. And for me, this has perfectly encapsulated the political process. And mm-hmm. the real point, then, as I was thinking about this, and I was thinking how difficult this must be to go around the country night after night and pretend to listen to everybody across the United States saying your position is horrible, and then to ignore all of them. And so what I want to get to, and don't worry, it's not like, oh my gosh, feel sorry for the Clintons, but it's been clear to me for decades now that the Democrats really have an impossible position, because the Republicans at least can say, you know, we want to screw everybody and we want corporations to win everything, and tough luck if you don't like it. But the Democrats have to pretend, like Bill Clinton, his great line about I feel your pain as he's signing NAFTA. So the Democrats have to pretend that they have to play a more difficult game than the Republicans. It's like good cop, bad cop. You know, the bad cop, right, can come in and just say, look, either you confess or I'm going to beat the crap out of you. And the bad cop comes in and says, no, man, I am your friend. I'm your last hope. And so the Democrats have to play that game. I'm done. So go wherever you want with that.
No, I think it's a perfect example of what we were talking about, for instance, with this so-called green capitalism, right? I mean, here's a Republican saying, no, screw environmental protections. Let's gut the EPA and let's just full on free market, no regulations, screw the environment, screw the worker. And here's the Democrats on the other side saying, no, wait a second. We don't want to like curtail capitalism, but let's green it up a little bit, right? Let's you know, polish it up a little bit, and we'll have some protections in place, you know, because, well, not a lot of them, like not enough to, you know, shut down the entire, you know, fracking industry, but just enough to like, well, maybe we'll protect some water in some areas, and we're still going to support the pipeline, but let's just like reroute that around the reservation. Right. I mean, it's a perfect example of the Democrats and the Republicans have the end game is exactly the same. Right. That Wall Street needs to profit. But getting to that point the Democrats have to massage it a little bit, where the Republicans straight up just tell you you're screwed, and that's okay because it's going to green your pockets with cash. So it's sort of an impossible game for if you're on the outside saying what the heck's going on? Who are we supposed to like believe here, right? I mean, obviously it sounds better. I mean, the Democrats at least are paying lip service to environmental protections, for example. But ultimately, the backroom deals are gutting them. And there's obviously, you could talk about that a long time, about NAFTA, for example, and what that did for the environment or to the environment, and how, you know, the World Trade Organization with the Democrats are all in on has destroyed countries all over the world. Our forests are suffering, our rivers are poisoned. You know, you can go on and on. Mountaintops in Virginia were getting blown off for decades under Democratic administrations. They're lockstep with the same agenda, and that's why big corporations pile money into the coffers of both parties, because they know they're just playing their cards, and whoever wins will pay, you know, give them what they want. And we've seen it time and time again. And so that's the reality we're in right now. And it wouldn't matter if Trump were in the White House or Hillary Clinton. These same powers would still be running the show.
They're two functional parts of the same machine. I think one of the most important words that you have said during this entire interview is the word apparatus. And can you talk, if you remember how you used it, can you talk about what you mean by that? Do you remember how you used it?
I remember I used it. I mean, I think that the apparatus, from a pretty, you know, black and white standpoint, is the forces in Wall Street on K Street in Washington that literally control the halls of power in Washington and in D.C. They write the legislation, whether it's our healthcare bills or environmental protections, and they do it in a way that always benefits their clients. And their clients are the big companies that we all hate, whether it's the coal companies, whether it's the, you know, oil companies, you name it. And those are the same companies that also line the pockets of both parties, both major parties. So a perfect example, I mean, let's get away from the, you know, environment for a second. Let's look at the healthcare bill, Obamacare. Obamacare, of course, was a total tragedy. Single payer was never on the table, and we were now stuck with this free market approach to healthcare that not everybody has equal access, obviously. Not everybody has the same care, obviously. And guess who supported that? All the insurance companies. And the insurance companies have been profiting. It's been a whirlwind for them, and they're going to continue that. And I think that's one of the reasons why Trump wasn't able to overturn it, because the insurance companies don't want it overturned. And that's who wrote the bill, through Max Baucus, a Montana senator at the time. And he was now a paid consultant for the health insurance industry. So, you know, it's a revolving, not only is it a revolving door, it's an apparatus that's in place to dictate to us, the regular people, who has control and what we have to swallow as far as not only the food we eat, and the water we drink, and the air we breathe, but the lives we live and the culture we live in.
So we have about 20 minutes left. So we have a fair amount of time, and I would like to start slowly transitioning to what do we do when faced, what do those of us who care about real justice and those of us who care more for coho salmon than Weyerhaeuser, what do those of us who care more about the continuation of life on the planet than the health of Wall Street, what do we do, and how do we work toward getting movements that have real power and sort of walk the line between being purists who can be pure as anything and never accomplish anything, or being co-opted into the system that specializes in co-opting everything?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a big proponent of starting small. I'm a big proponent of local everything, politics, food, water, everything. And I think that's where we need to start. I live down in Long Beach, California. I grew up in Montana, lived in Oregon a long time as well. And one of the things that I've seen happening in every place I've lived is this movement towards local, especially when it comes to food. I think it's a great start when people have access to food cooperatives. Down here, a lot of people grow their own food. There's crop swappers all over the place, meetings that happen, and people can go and share food. And what this does is not only build community, but it allows people to eat healthy. And then also, they don't have to go to a big box store like Whole Foods to buy food. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. And it's a small thing, right? It's a very small thing, but it's also a very big thing because it's an act of resistance in that it isn't supporting this big monolithic egg business. And instead, it's bringing it back to the source, which is our own homes and our own gardens. And I think that's an example of something that can not only transform a small community, but it can transform cities. And I think it could transform entire regions over time, especially as climate change continues to rear its ugly head. So those are the things that give me a lot of hope. Another thing that gives me a lot of hope is it's evolving at this point, but the Standing Rock movement was, I think, probably the greatest thing to come out of the Obama administration, the days of the Obama administration. I mean, here we were, we saw a huge resistance, something that we hadn't seen in that regard with the environment, and I can't even remember how long. That gives me a lot of hope as well. And of course, that movement has to transform and become something greater, and it can't become co-opted by the big green organizations. And I think it has to stay in the hands of Native Americans, and especially I will fight so that it doesn't become, you know, in control of the hands of white men, because it seems that every time it does, movements that tend to die. So those are, you know, there's a lot of things that give me a lot of hope for the future. And I think it does start local. And then, of course, I think local campaigns. I think even though I'm an anarchist, I still believe that we can transform our cities by electing progressives at the local level and those that believe in social justice issues, that want to fight for affordable housing, want access, everybody to have good access to local education, those kind of things. And those can really make a difference in day-to-day lives. And it's not about party politics at all. It's about issues. And I think those are the kind of things that we can do to transform our society from the ground up. And I think it's happening in front of us right now. We just have to look around.
You know, what you say there, I think, is a great example of one of the ways that the right has succeeded and the left has failed. Is one of the reasons you get those crazy school boards who say that we're only going to teach that the earth is 6,000 years old is because for decades, and this is going to be cliches, but for decades, the right wing has been pushing hard for people to become politically engaged in the system, even though many of them recognize that it's pretty messed up too. And at the same time, a lot of lefties have been sneering at the political system and, you know, retiring to the homestead to raise marijuana.
And right.
We see that even locally. This story cracks me up, that there's the local school board where I live. I live in Del Norte County, tiny little town, Crescent City, and it's a beautiful town, and the politics are very right wing. It's basically Mississippi on the North Coast.
Yeah, I love Crescent City, but yeah, the politics are leave much to be desired.
Yeah, and the right wing stacked the library board at one point.
Yeah.
And they stacked it with people who don't like to read. And so there's this big, which I don't understand this, but there was this big controversy a couple years ago because they said the library is the worst library I've ever seen in any town. It's tiny and underfunded. But it ends up that the reason it was so bad is because they had been sitting on all their library funds. They had hundreds of thousands of dollars of library funds that they just never bothered to spend. And so no wonder you have a crap library. And, right. And so in a tangible sense, our library was crap because the right wing had done a really good job, for whatever reason, and I don't know why they particularly hated libraries. That's perhaps a whole nother interview. But anyway, they had done a fabulous job of packing every little local board. And we, you, me, and the people who agree with this, have done an absolutely terrible job of that for the last several decades.
Oh, it's absolutely correct. And whether it's the library board, or, I mean, we've seen it with the school board coming from Portland, Oregon, a very progressive city where everybody, at least I ever met, believes in public education, yet all the public schools, especially the high schools, are crumbling. The, you know, two high schools in the last 5 years have been closed that were in poor neighborhoods. These are public institutions that are being shut down in progressive cities. And why? Because the people on the school boards are actually politically right-wingers. And, these are things that affect the fabric of the places that we live. And unless we take over and start reweaving that fabric in our own communities, it's going to continue to rot, no matter who's in the White House, right? And so I think, when talking about resistance starts locally. And it's not always just a protest. It's a reclaiming of our society and a reclaiming of our source of nurture and nature, right? And some of the best activism comes from local activism and people that you and I have never met or heard of that are fighting for what they believe in and making a difference in their lives and probably hundreds of others that are in their communities. And I think that's where it starts. That's where the resistance starts. And frankly, that's, the only way tangibly that we can do stuff is small little cogs in this enormous, machine. So we have to, we have to pull out little screws where we can and hope that we can transform the way we live. And I believe that we can, and I believe that we are. I mean, I know growing up, I grew up in an agricultural state where in Montana, where, both of my parents came from farms. My dad's family was sharecroppers, and everybody was connected to food, but yet there were no farmers markets back then. Not that I ever remember, but now farmers markets where farmers are coming, they grow food, they come, they don't have big farms, they come, they make some money, you can buy their pickles, you can buy their great produce. And not only is that a great thing for that community, but it's empowering, right? I mean, this is an agricultural community in Montana where I was from, yet we were so disconnected from our food that we had no idea even where it came from. And now I think it's transformed in the last 20 to 30 years where people now understand that. And they get it, and that gives me hope, and that transcends politics, and that's just about human nature. And I think we're on the right track. I see it in the community I live in now. 5, 10 years ago, there weren't any. There was like one farmer's market, and now every day of the week there's a farmer's market in a different part of this of town. And that gives me a tremendous amount of hope that people coming together can make radical changes in their own lives.
Okay, so people listening to this interview, they go, man, it'd be a great idea to run for the library board and to start a farmer's market and to go for the school board, and they do. And so we start getting some lefty or environmentalist or whatever we want to call it, people in our school board, in these school boards, in the library boards, and all this stuff. So plan A of our plot to stop the capitalist war machine works. And we now, libraries are cool places, farmers market are cool places. Okay, then how do we scale this up to actually stop the bombing of Yemeni children? How does this transform the larger capitalist system then?
Well, I think what this does is,
And how do we keep from being co-opted by those dastardly Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, and that is the question of the day, right? And I would argue that once we have convictions, our convictions may be, you know, we're anti-war, we're pro-environment, you don't allow those deep-held beliefs to be compromised in any form, ever. And that means that if there are, at the national level or the state level or even, you know, a local level, someone is running for office, let's say it's even Bernie Sanders and he's running as a Democrat, and Bernie's great on a lot of issues, right? He's great on healthcare and he's great on education, but he's horrible on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and he's horrible when it comes to, you know, the war on terror. He supports it. He voted to continue funding it time and time again. But yet, so many people that didn't agree with him on that were willing to look the other way. Well, I would argue that not only do you not need, you know, you should not look the other way, you need to tell Bernie Sanders and the Democrats, you're not going to get my vote unless you earn my vote. And until either major party earns that vote, they shouldn't get that vote. Because what's going to happen, and it has happened for the last 20 years, the Democrats know that progressives and radicals have those who vote have nowhere else to go. And so in the end of the day, they're going to come back to, you know, the prison of the Democratic Party. Well, until people decide, no, I'm not going to vote against my own interests and against my deep-held beliefs, and at all costs, no matter what the outcome of this election, then you're going to have some Democrats that are going to start listening. When they realize that, wait, we are not only turning our back on constituents, we are losing elections because we aren't progressive enough, that's when they may wake up. And will they wake up? I don't know. But what I do know is they will only listen to us if they fear that their power is being threatened. And until that happens, they're going to continue to do what they're doing. And so we have to exert whatever power we can to you know, crash the ship, as it may. And, you know, hopefully that's taking down the Democrats and Republicans along with it. And until they listen to us, then, you know, then they should lose, and they deserve to lose.
You know, this makes me think of when you said that they have to fear us. That makes me think of who is, in effect, the best environmental president of the last 60 years, which would be Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon, yeah.
And, you know, we've got NEPA, we have Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act. And he was a nature-hating madman, just like anybody else. But he was terrified of the people made him scared because they were so upset with so many of the things he was doing that he was started throwing them bones.
And that's right.
It seems to me that that's a really important lesson that we have forgotten in the last 47 years.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, and the stakes are higher now than they were even then. But, you know, looking back at the Nixon administration and the, you know, Nader's raiders through the 70s that were able to give us OSHA and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and all of the people that were involved in that, you know, they might have been the ones that were wheeling and dealing in the halls of power, but what gave them a voice was the people that were voicing their objections in the streets and in their communities. And until we can do that now, we're not going to exert our power, whatever power we may have. You know, and another example, you know, they're not the politics that I endorse, or of course you don't either, but the Tea Party, the right wing of the Republican Party is, not only are they, of course, they're absolutely crazy, but they are unwilling to compromise. And what we've seen it do is even pull the Republicans further to the right. Now, the left hasn't learned that lesson, right? I mean, because the left compromises all the time. But we could learn a few things from that crazy right-wing nuts that are unwilling to compromise, because with what they've done is essentially pull the Republican Party in their direction, and I would argue the Democrats along with it, because there's no force on the other side of the spectrum pulling the Democrats. So we have to build that force of resistance.
And so we have maybe 4 or 5 minutes left, and what you've talked a little bit about the importance of farmers markets, etc., and you've talked about voting or not voting, and I am not here, unless you want to, making a call for a tax on infrastructure or anything like that, But what do you mean by force them to the left? What I'm curious about the word force here. What and I don't want to make you uncomfortable. Just what?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think
whatever direction you want with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that on a very simple level, it means not compromising. So that means don't vote for anybody that doesn't actually believe in or represent the issues that you believe in. I mean, that's when you're in the voting booth. And I would say on a personal level, don't allow a oil company to come into your backyard and start drilling oil. And I would argue by any means necessary to stop that from happening. I would argue that you build resistance locally to many, many different things that are happening. You know, Standing Rock would be one example. And I think in every community, there's something that's happening that people can stand up for, whether it's, you know, the closing of schools or, you know, crumbling streets and infrastructure. And you find an issue, you take it on, and you fight tooth and nail to protect it. And I would argue that basing that ethic around the environment is a very, very good place to start. And with that, it can transform your own communities and be uncompromising in your beliefs and in your vigilance, because once you compromise, you give in and you lose ground, and we don't have time to lose more ground.
So I think two things. One of them is that a friend of mine always says, and this is really true, that the big distinction is not between those who think we need to dismantle the whole system and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. So when we're talking about forcing, this is not necessarily, you know, manning the barricades, although it could be. This can also be simply showing up. And I'm thinking of a very small example that's happening in my own community, in my own neighborhood, I live in bear territory. We see bears every day, literally every day. And I love it. And there's a neighborhood watch email list that's pissing me off, because it used to be just, oh, there's some guy, there was a burglary last night in somebody's house, so everybody watch out your house. That's all fine. But it's been converted into people are freaking out. There was a note last night, all caps, there's a bear in the neighborhood. And they did this, they got really histrionic last December and got a bear killed by Fish and Game because they were complaining so much.
Mm-hmm.
And my point on this is, even though this is a very, very small thing, but whenever anybody in the neighborhood sends out an email going, gosh, there's a bear, this is terrible, I always write back and say, how wonderful, you got to see a bear. I'm so happy. And we live in their home. And don't you think it's wonderful to live here in a place where there is the natural world? So it's like, just on that itty bitty level, I want there to be that level of resistance. And even though this, it's so weird, people ask me all the time, aren't you scared to write all this radical stuff? Because what are people going to think? It's like, no, what I really care about is what the frickin' neighbors think about me. That's the thing that's hard for me, is to write to the neighbors and say, don't freak out, because they're my neighbors and I have to see them every day.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I feel the same way. I grew up in a pretty right-wing culture in town. And but, you know, what's really interesting is when you do start doing those things on the small scale, like emailing your neighbors when they're complaining about something or whatever it is, maybe it's a Facebook conversation or something. You know what it does, though, is it opens up a conversation. And I think in many cases, it allows the person that you might be disagreeing with to come around and to say, oh, wait, yeah, you might be right. And that, I think, is such a great act of resistance, especially in small communities that might be tilted to the right, because ultimately you might find common ground and more things that you disagree with. And that can build coalitions in many ways, depending on the issue. And I think it's a really good place to start. So I totally agree. I think even a small one-on-one email in certain cases, or a comment, if someone posts something on Facebook you don't agree with, just saying, this isn't right, you know, that's an act of resistance in and of itself. And those ones oftentimes can make a really big impact.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying is we are basically out of time. It sounds to me like what you're saying is the antidote to the co-optation that the Democrats and the apparatus itself uses the Democrats to accomplish, that two of the solutions to that are, one, to get involved on whatever level, get off your butt and do something, and the other solution is to basically get off your butt and do something. Is that a reasonable...
I think that's a very, very good start. Could you imagine if 10 million people tomorrow woke up and did something? The 10 million people that agree with us got up and did something small. Maybe they helped someone cross the street. Maybe they planted a tree. Maybe they went to the farmer's market. Maybe they sent off an angry email to a neighbor. But they did something. That would make an impact. And I believe in a snowball effect that would then entice another 10 million people to go out and do something. And that's how you transform society. And I think it starts with getting off our butts and unplugging our phones and getting out there and meeting people and making things happen.
Well, that's great. And I want to give my great-grandmother the final word here. And that's, she said to my mother all the time when my mother was a little girl, inch by inch, life's a cinch, yard by yard, life's hard. And I think that's what you do. You get up and then you don't destroy capitalism in one day. You do your thing today and you do your thing tomorrow. And then before you know it, you've been able to take a big chunk out of capitalism.
That's great. I agree. I like your grandmother very much.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And you've been perfect. And thank you for listening. My guest today has been Joshua Frank. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.